Most of you, or many of you, have been coming along. The first talk was an overview of the five stages of spiritual life. The second talk was about integration, which we saw was very closely connected with awareness. Awareness is the key to integration. The third talk was on positive emotion, which we saw was very much about skillfulness, kusala karma. And 2 weeks ago, I gave a talk on spiritual death, and I talked about other metaphors for the same stage of the path, spiritual victory and vision and so on. And tonight's talk is on the stage of spiritual rebirth. So we'll maybe find out a bit about what that means tonight. So, what kind of flower are you? I think for probably the first 3 decades of my life, if not a bit more, I think I was a shrinking violet. Probably lots of complex reasons for that. I wasn't very socialized early in life due to living in a very rural situation. And I think I was very shy and a natural introvert and so on. So as far back as I can remember, I lived with some kind of uneasy fear of the world around me. For whatever reasons, I was a shrinking violet. And that was internalized and became a very habitual way of being in the world. As I say, that's probably into my 30s. I wouldn't characterize myself as a shrinking violet anymore. Maybe it's up to other people to say what flower they think I might be. Maybe a sunflower or something. Anyway, that's just by way of taking us into the parable of the rain cloud in the White Lotus Sutra, which many of you will be aware of. So in the parable of the rain cloud, the Buddha compares the Dharma to the rain, to the monsoon rain in India. And he compares people, that's us, to the plants which grow and flourish when the rains come, when the monsoon comes. So I'll just read a bit of the parable of the rain cloud. It says, all the various trees, lofty, medium, low, each according to its size, grows and develops roots, stalks, branches, leaves, blossoms and fruits in their brilliant colors. Wherever the one rain reaches, all become fresh and glossy, according as their bodies, forms and natures are great or small. So the enriching rain, though it is one and the same, makes each of them flourish. Ever to all beings, I preach the Dharma equally. As I preach to one person, so I preach to all. Ever I proclaim the Dharma, engaged in naught else, going, coming, sitting, standing. Never am I weary of pouring it copious on the world, like the all-enriching rain. On honoured and humbled, high and low, law-keepers and law-breakers, those of perfect character and those of imperfect, orthodox and heterodox, quick-witted and dull-witted, equally I rain the Dharma rain unwearyingly. And of course, all the shrubs, all the flowers, all the plants, all the bushes, all the trees, they all grow in their own unique way. And similarly, what the Buddha is saying is all the people hearing the Dharma, all the people hearing and practicing the Dharma, grow and develop in their own unique way, according to their character, according to their temperament, their abilities, their capacities, and so on. So at this stage of the stages of spiritual life, this stage of spiritual rebirth, we begin to see what kind of plant we are, what kind of flower we are, what kind of tree we are. We begin to realize at this stage what kind of Buddhist we are and what kind of Buddha and Bodhisattva we're becoming. Bhante Sangharakshita referred to this stage as the stage of transformation. So again, this is important not to get too stuck on words or images or metaphors. It's the stage of spiritual rebirth, but also he talked about it as the stage of transformation. And transformation, of course, is symbolized by things like flames here on the kesa or the lotus on the kesa. And Bhante says, this is when the vision that you have seen or experienced starts, as it were, descending and transforming every aspect of your being. So that's what he said about this stage. And we can see that although we're speaking in terms of stages, this is really a process that begins when we first respond to the Dharma, and it continues until it bears fruit in enlightenment. So right from when we first hear the Dharma, when we first hear and respond to the Dharma, we have this experience of being transformed. I think it was earlier this year, sometime on Sangha night, we had four mitras talking on the theme of why I asked for ordination. And the answer in a nutshell was that the Dharma had transformed them. That's why they'd asked for ordination. How they lived their lives, how they thought about their lives, had been transformed by their engagement with the Dharma. So like flowers nourished by the rain and opening to the sun, their hearts have been opened. So this is spiritual rebirth beginning to happen, even at this stage. Or even earlier, people ask to become mitras because they have experienced the transforming power of the Dharma. And as we continue to hear the Dharma, and as we continue to be transformed by the Dharma, we become more and more the individual we really are. So the protective armor, the defensive strategies of our egotism just slowly dissolves away. And all the many faces that we show the world give way to our, what you could call our true face, the face of the Buddha or the Bodhisattva that we're becoming. So qualities begin to shine through. Our gifts and our abilities are more and more in the service of the Dharma. So we're being reborn. Yeah, we're shedding the shell or the chrysalis of self-concern and emerging in all our splendor. Yeah. And as time goes by, we become the answer, as it were, to the request that's in Bhante's poem, Secret Wings. I don't know if many of you have heard this poem, Secret Wings. There's a kind of request in there. And it says, "Oh, cry no more that you are weak, but stir and spread your secret wings and say, the world is bright because we glimpse the starriness of things. Soar with your rainbow plumes and reach that near far land where all are one, where beauty's face is eye unveiled and every star shall be a sun." So every star shall be a sun. Every Buddhist shall be a Buddha. Buddhism has a positive goal. It's not just about the negation of egotism or the absence of greed, hatred and delusion. There's a real positive content to the enlightenment experience. And that positive content manifests. It manifests in actions, it manifests in words, thoughts, and in imagination. Hakuin said, "Apart from water, no ice. Outside living beings, no Buddhas." So the ideal of Buddhism can seem abstract sometimes. We talk about enlightenment or nirvana or whatever. It can seem abstract. But the Buddha was not an abstraction. We aim to emulate the Buddha, to become Buddhas, not to become abstractions. But emulating the Buddha and becoming the Buddha is not about becoming just like a man who wandered northern India 2,500 years ago. That would be a kind of absurd undertaking to try to become like the Buddha in that way. So we have to use our awareness and our imagination to discern and experience what kind of Buddha we can be. We need to develop our imaginal faculty, our imaginal power, to get a sense of who the Buddha really was and what being a Buddha really means. Yeah? So there are some traditional practices that are meant to enable us to awaken our awareness and our imagination of the Buddha. There's Vasubandhu, one of the Indian teachers, taught four practices, and two of those four practices are the recollection of the Buddhas and the contemplation of the virtues or the qualities of the, well, it says the Tathagatas, but it's against the Buddhas. And Bhante writes about these in his book, The Meaning of Conversion in Buddhism. He says, in recollecting the Buddhas, one brings to mind the historical Buddha Shakyamuni, who lived in India 2,500 years ago, and the lineage of his great predecessors, of which the Buddhist tradition speaks. In particular, one reflects that these Buddhas started their spiritual careers as human beings, with their weaknesses and limitations, just as we do. Just as they managed to transcend all limitations to become enlightened, so can we, if we make the effort. So that's what Bhante is saying about recollecting the Buddha. There's a lot more that could be said about recollecting the Buddha. And in fact, I'm giving a talk on Dharma Day where I'm going to be saying more about recollecting the Buddha. Yeah. Then there's, Bhante goes on to say, there are several ways of approaching the practice of the contemplation of the virtues of the Tathagata. One can dwell on the life of the enlightened one, the spiritual biography of the Buddha, or Milarepa, for example. One can perform pujas in front of a shrine, or perhaps just sit and look at a Buddha image, really trying to get a feeling of what the image represents. Then again, one can do a visualization practice in which, to be very brief indeed, one conjures up a vivid mental picture of a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva. So that's what Bhante says about those two particular practices. I mean, our threefold puja is also a kind of recollection of the Buddha. When we say the Buddha was born as we are born, what the Buddha overcame, we too can overcome. What the Buddha attained, we too can attain. That is a kind of, you could say it's a reflection or a contemplation of the Buddha. It's, you know, when you say it isn't, but you can contemplate it and go into it. Or those of you who know the Tiratanavandana, traditionally the first verse of the Tiratanavandana is a recollection of the Buddha. That's what it is, it's a recollection of the Buddha. And of course, reading a life of the Buddha, such as the book by Vishupani, Gautama, is a good way to get a feeling for the Buddha as a person with a spiritual practice. And or going on pilgrimage. I know some of you have been on pilgrimage, but going on pilgrimage to the Buddhist holy places in India is another way. And the contemplation of the qualities of enlightenment or of the Buddha is reflected in our study, in our pujas, our shrines, our images, in the sadhana practices of order members and so on. All these many diverse images of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, these archetypal images such as Amitabha, Avalokiteshvara, Green Tara, whatever, all these images are produced from the depths of meditation, and they speak to us, speak to our depths. They speak to us in a way that words and ideas may never do. These images emerged from the meditations of unique people, unique minds, unique experiences, and we, in our uniqueness, as it were, may respond to some and not to others. There are so many figures, so many colors, so many gestures, qualities, associations, and so on. there are many, many different archetypes of enlightenment, symbolizing and emphasizing different qualities. And they are like the plants and the trees and so on of the parable of the rain cloud, the different unique individuals we can grow into. Of course, we may even become a Buddha, a kind of Buddha as yet unimagined. Now, all these different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas symbolize enlightened or awakened consciousness in its fullness, and they each emphasize particular qualities of the awakened individual. So they're both emphasizing particular qualities, particular aspects, and they symbolize the totality of awakened consciousness. So these figures and their qualities, they also indicate ways to practice, as it were, a path of wisdom, a path of compassion, a path of beauty, a path of meditation, a path of energy, a path of generosity, and so on. Now, spiritual rebirth manifests in great faith, Shraddha. It manifests in unshakable faith in the three jewels. Because at this stage, the stage of spiritual rebirth, we are embodying the three jewels more and more. And as you're embodying it more and more, you're experiencing fruits of practice. So faith has a very firm basis. And spiritual rebirth also manifests in altruistic activity, spontaneous altruistic activity, because there is less ego to get in the way, less worry, less fear, less anxiety, less self-concern, less need for praise, less fear of blame. So by this stage, positive emotion is more established and more present all the time. By this stage, integration is manifesting as the unique kind of plant, as it were, that you are. So by this stage, the victory over self-centeredness is the norm. So altruistic, generous, kindly activity is becoming the naturally unpremeditated way to behave. Yeah, to be and to behave. So as well as manifesting in great faith and in altruism, spiritual rebirth also manifests as an appreciation of beauty and less desire to possess. So there's a greater appreciation of beauty and there's less desire to possess. Possessiveness and pride and fear and status, all of those things, they kill beauty. And when they decrease, beauty is more present all the time. This is what Bhante has referred to as the greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation. An attitude towards the world, an attitude towards people that is not about wanting something for yourself. It's not about wanting to use or to own everything. It's an attitude that's content with little and appreciates everything. Spiritual rebirth is not really something that can be practiced. In a way, it's the result of practice. However, spiritual rebirth can't be divorced from spiritual death or spiritual victory, as we talked about at last. Spiritual death is a way of talking about that kind of deeper understanding, clear vision that brings about transformation in our lives. And spiritual rebirth is a way of talking about how that transformation is then expressed, how that transformation unfolds in our lives and manifests in the world. There are two ways of looking at spiritual practice. You can see spiritual practice as a kind of a discipline, as a means to bring about growth and development, and that's what it is for most of us most of the time. practice as a path of transformation. But then there's also practice as an expression of transformation. Practice as the expression of deeper understanding. Practice as the expression of clearer vision. So the practice of ethics, for instance, can be seen as a discipline, a training that we undertake in order to become more ethical, to experience higher states of consciousness, or ethical practice can be an expression of higher states of consciousness. And the same applies to meditation, to ritual, to contemplation and so on. They can see them all in terms of a practice in order to transform, or a practice that is the expression of transformation. And at this stage of spiritual rebirth, this stage of transformation, any practice, ethical practice for instance, will be more natural and spontaneous. Engagement in ritual or devotion will be more like an enactment of the nature of reality. Buddhahood is the highest expression of humanity, and to orientate ourselves in the direction of Buddhahood in all our activities, it's both a practice, as I said, and can be an expression of realization. So to ritually orientate ourselves in the direction of Buddhahood through puja, for instance, is a necessity for most of us, yeah? For those of us who aspire to realization. But it's the natural expression of realization for those who have been transformed through practice. And at this stage of spiritual rebirth, puja, devotion, even a kind of prayer, are the practices most likely to engender the attitude and the spirit of transcendent consciousness and give a flavor of Buddha mind. Even acting on kind and generous impulses is a practice that can both lead in the direction of transformation and give a flavor of those higher states of mind. So many people get a hint of spiritual rebirth through a connection with an archetypal Buddha or Bodhisattva, through contemplating images of particular Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, chanting their mantras, meditating on their qualities, even talking to them, or acting as if you were that particular figure. You know, acting as if you were Tara or Amoghasiddhi or whoever. And that this kind of intense imaginative interaction leads to a relationship with reality, which is via symbol and image. So it's an imaginative relationship with reality. We had some of this last week when Shaki Kumara was taking us through the theme of Vajrasattva, a particularly beautiful evocation of Vajrasattva. So imagination, you could say, is really essential to insight. Imagination is essential to spiritual death and rebirth. Enlightenment is not conceptual. It's not a rational, ideas-based experience. It's much more akin to the experience of being moved by great art, music, or by the natural environment or something. It's much more akin to that type of experience. That kind of experience just speaks to us on deeper levels that involve, as it were, the whole of us, heart and head and heart, emotions and thoughts, and they're all united in this imaginative identification with reality. In Ratnaguna's book, Great Faith, Great Wisdom, which is a great book, I think, there's a quote from a guy called Aaron Hughes, which defines imagination. And it says, imagination is the faculty that experiences and expresses in sensible form that which is essentially inexpressible. So that's what archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are doing. They're expressing through the senses, in sensible form, through the senses, that which is essentially inexpressible. So spiritual rebirth is the arena of imagination and inspiration. Inspired by the Buddha, we make an imaginative leap out of our mundane concerns into the great expansive cosmic reaches of reality. So it's very important to allow for inspiration in our lives. We need to become aware of what inspires us, what fires us up. And as much as possible, stay close to our sources of inspiration. Because being inspired motivates us to practice. Being inspired motivates us, and it's the training, the practice, that eventually leads to the imaginative breakthrough that we call insight or spiritual death or spiritual victory or vision or whatever. That's the transformation that allows the qualities of awakened consciousness to manifest more and more through our uniqueness. The great Tibetan yogi Milarepa, we've got his image on the shrine this evening. This is Milarepa. Milarepa is a supreme example of the stages of the spiritual path, I think. And in his songs, in the songs of Milarepa, because that's what he's, as it were, famous for, is his songs, the songs of Milarepa. We hear the expression of inspiration, imagination, kindness, compassion, realization. And one of those songs that many of us here will be familiar with, because we've probably heard it at the end of a retreat or something, is the song of meeting and parting. Who's heard the song of meeting and parting? Oh, not as many as I thought. Okay, but yeah. So the first verse goes like this. In the immense blue sky above, roll on the sun and moon. Their courses mark the change of time. Blue sky, I wish you health and fortune, for I, the sun and moon, am leaving to visit the four continents for pleasure. So this is the poet, Milarepa, giving a personality to the sun and moon and to the blue sky. And that personality is expressing metta. It's expressing metta towards the blue sky, which is all, both are experienced or perceived as living beings. Milarepa has a very close, intimate connection with nature, with the natural world. And this is where he finds his images. And of course, also in there you have a reminder of impermanence. He's leaving to visit the four continents for pleasure, it says. Bhante says, by the way, that this phrase, for pleasure, might be better translated as out of sheer bliss. That's what the sense of it is. It's out of sheer bliss that he's going. So the whole verse is a kind of exuberant outpouring of joy. It's a kind of exulting in the nature of reality. And then in the second verse, the Milarepa, the poet, envisages a vulture speaking to a rock, and with the same reminder of impermanence. So on the mountain peak is a great rock, round which circles oft the vulture, the king of birds. Their meeting and their parting marked a change of time. Dear rock, be well and healthy, for I, the vulture, will now fly away into the vast space for pleasure. May lightnings never strike you. May I not be caught by snares. Inspired by the Dharma, may we soon meet again in prosperity and boon. So again, as a kind of expression of metta, the vulture is identifying with the rock. He's saying, may lightnings never strike you, whatever. He's identifying very closely with the rock. And it goes on like that. In the next verse, I think it's a fish speaking to the stream. Sort of personification, the fish is saying, may I not be caught by fishermen, and may you not be irrigated, or whatever it is. So it's this kind of imaginative identification of the fish with the stream. So there's this constant reminders of what metta, compassion, and impermanence throughout. So it's like wisdom and compassion throughout the whole poem. And each verse finishes with the refrain, inspired by the Dharma, may we soon meet again in prosperity and boon. Inspired by the Dharma. So there's this constant reference to the inspiration of the Dharma. So Milarepa's song is a kind of hymn, a hymn to impermanence, which is, as I say, symbolizing the wisdom aspect of awakening, and to metta, symbolizing the compassion aspect of awakening. And it's also a hymn to the inspiration derived from the Dharma. And the whole song is framed in highly imaginative terms that lift us into a realm of beauty and richness. So I thought that for this talk, a really appropriate way to end a talk, and as a special treat to you, I've asked Artur Siddhi to sing Milarepa's song of meeting and parting, to help us to soar into those exalted realms. I hope I'm not setting Artur Siddhi up too much. To soar into the exalted realms of the yogi Milarepa, and that highly evocative imagination of the nature of reality. Yeah?